Welcome to the Domestic Abuse Breakthrough Show, where we tackle violence against women and girls through education, empowerment, and hope. Join Kate, a survivor and advocate, as she shares insights, strategies, and stories that inspire healing and action. Together, we'll break the cycle and pave the way for a future of safety and strength. This show contains a trigger warning. And now, here's your host, Kate Beasley.
So welcome back to another episode. And last week, Alistair, we closed off talking about the importance of understanding motive. What was driving the behaviour?
It's so important. You have to understand the psychology. I mean, it's like they want, you know, serial killers, for example, or serial stalkers. Usually all their victims have something in common. Well, we need to identify, well, what do all these victims have in common, and where does that connect back to them and their wound? Do these victims remind them of their mother, and do they carry a lot of anger and hate and resentment towards their mother? Do they envisage in their mind that they're, by punishing these victims, that they are punishing their mother? Did their mother harm them when they were kids, when they were younger? We need to understand this to understand the psychology of the people we're dealing with.
Yeah.
It's so important. Psychology of the victim, and the victim and the perpetrator, and the psychology and trauma responses is so important. It's a huge part of it. And that's why I go into a lot of detail in it in my training. Because it's crucially important. It's as important. We can have all the knowledge in the world on coercive control, stalking, all the other abuse-related crimes. But if we don't understand the psychology of the people that we're dealing with, all that knowledge in the world is useless. It can only take you so far.
Yep, absolutely. Absolute sense. Yes, it does. I really wish that we had that training in trauma and being, trauma informed. But it wasn't even breathed.
No.
Back then.
No.
And
even today, Alistair, it's not. I know. When people refer to trauma-informed training, there's a lot of the time in the professional arena, it's using contradictory language. You know, you can't in one breath say that you can't in one breath say that a perpetrator had knew what they were doing, and in the next breath say that they're psychologically disordered, because the two are very contradictory terms. To say the disordered, to say that they lack capacity. And this is where the problem is coming in. So, you know, I'm saying we need to understand what's driving the behavior, but it's not from an excuse perspective. It's not minimizing. It's to understand what's driving it. Where's the motive? You know, what's going on inside their head?
Exactly. Yeah, what's going on inside their heads?
Yeah.
Because something is going on inside their heads.
And they have initiated this intentional behavior to get a grip of what they're feeling. It's what they're feeling. Yep. They don't want to feel whatever their victim has triggered inside them. It's soothing whatever the root cause has triggered within them. So they are seeing this victim. It's reminding them. So a flashback is nothing more than a memory. It's a memory of a past event that represents an inescapable emotion. So what does that person remind you of from your childhood that's causing you to feel okay,
Yep.
I need to punish that person. Why? Why? Well, because my mum beat me as a child. I hate my mum. She made me feel like shit. She made me feel it worthless, unloved, waste of space. And you remind me of my mother. Okay,
My
so I'm
mother.
going to target you. And that's what a flashback is. That's what a flashback is. It's a memory. It's nothing more than a memory
Memory, yes.
of those snapshots that are stored away in the long-term memory.
But that's still incredibly powerful.
It is.
That memory.
It is. Again, it's not. It's never to excuse. It is purely to understand what's driving the behavior. That's it. Because if we can
I don't.
understand what's driving the behavior, then we can risk manage better.
Yes, I can see that, and that's absolutely the case. But I'm wondering, and this may be off topic in some ways, or maybe not. What is an explanation for those of us who did have abusive mothers who turn into serial killers? How did we survive? How did we become, well, more or
Because
less?
it's not a case. So you can have two siblings that grow up in the exact same household. One could turn out to be a perpetrator, and the other one could turn out to be heavily codependent. Or the other one, I mean, again, we've seen many examples where, women, men have grown up in a single parent and with a single mom. They act not they they've act, They're very aware of what their father was like, and they have chosen, I am not going to be like that. I have seen, I mean, I interviewed Wes Cunncliffe. Now, Wes Cunncliffe grew up, his mum was a victim of domestic abuse. And he's gone the other way. So he's observed. So you either do one of two things. You either identify it as, oh, well, that's the way to gain compliance. That's the way to get people to do what I want. That's the way to feel empowered. That's the way to soothe my wounds. Or you see it as, oh, I've seen what devastation this causes. I do not ever want to be like that. So it depends on how the brain interprets what they're observing. If they observe it as learned behavior and a way of soothing their own wounds, then that's what they'll take on. They're more inclined to become a perpetrator. If they observe it and think, I hate what I'm seeing, and if there is a child, they are very submissive. Again, it depends on what their role is as a child. If they become very submissive towards the perpetrator as a way of survival, that's generally the traits they'll take on throughout their life. So they're more inclined to become the victim as opposed to the perpetrator. They're more vulnerable to becoming the victim because they will target their insecurities. They will have a lot of self-worth issues. So it's literally interpretation. It's how that child observes what's going on within their landscape and how they interpret it. Because if they interpret it as, I ain't ever going to be like that. You have done X, Y, and Z to my mother, and I'm never going to turn out like that.
The station that makes you feel good.
If you see the letters AIDA, do you immediately think of the opera by Verdi? AIDA is also an advertising acronym for those iconic Mad Men days. A is for attention, I is for interest, D is for desire, A is for action. This process is a timeless truism for making a sale. Fortunately, if your product or service is health-related, we can offer you guaranteed access to a global audience with a high interest in health, healthy lifestyle, and contemporary well-being. UKHealthRadio.com has a regular monthly audience of around 1.5 million health-conscious people. And Health Triangle, its award-winning monthly magazine, has around 20,000 paying subscribers. Find out more about both at UKHealthRadio.com. Let's all put health first.
Hey, are you tired of the irritation you get down there from pads and other bladder weakness products? Tennis Sensitive Care Pads are the first ever bladder weakness pads enriched with a skin comfort formula. The skin-friendly layer in combination with the soft, 100% breathable materials helps protect intimate skin from irritation. And as always, you have triple protection from leaks, odor, and moisture. Gynecologist tested and dermatologically approved by the Skin Health Alliance. Look for Tena Sensitive Care Pads with the Skin Comfort Formula online and in stores now.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
But yet, if they end up, and this is where the key is, if they end up taking on undesirable coping mechanisms as a way of either getting what they want, gaining compliance, or soothing a wound, this is where we have to take notice. Because if a child is engaging in those behaviours, regardless of what words are coming out of their mouth, cognitively, you know, intelligently, through the using their active thinking brain, they're like, no, I never want to be like my dad. But if they are learning on a nervous system level that those behaviors, taking on those behaviors that they're observing, then they will, when the more they're reinforced as a child, the stronger that entitlement becomes as an adult.
Yeah.
It's harder to break that cycle. So we need to break that cycle when they're younger by enforcing age-appropriate consequences before that entitlement becomes too embedded.
Yeah, I can see that. I remember...
But if they end up becoming submissive as a child and pandering to the perpetrator and becoming more of a people pleaser, and then that's where they'll tend to go the other way, and they're more prone to be falling prey to other perpetrators as they go through their life. There's no one size fits all. It's not a case of if you've grown up in that environment, you are going to become a perpetrator. You could also become more prone to being the victim.
Yeah.
Which was obviously what happened in my case. I became, because I was very much the peacemaker throughout my childhood, pandering to the perpetrator, micromanaging escalation, and I was doing a lot of it subconsciously. So obviously I took on those traits throughout my whole life. So you've got to look at how the child's behaving from a young age through their childhood, and that is usually your telltale signs.
I remember a few of those moments where I did think to myself, I don't want to be that person.
And that's what I mean. It's how you interpret it. And if you don't take on the behaviours as coping mechanisms, then that's where you end up going the other way. But ultimately, the perpetrator and the victim, quite often, not all the time, obviously, but quite a lot of the time, they have similar childhoods. It's the victim, the ever-pleasing, people-pleasing victim. Well, that's music to a perpetrator's ears, who have taken on undesirable coping mechanisms and learned that manipulation and intimidation gains compliance and gets what they want. So it's a match made in heaven, I suppose, or a match made in hell, as the case may be. It is, because it is a music to the perpetrator's ears. Because they are, their victim is 99% of the time an ever pleasing, people pleasing person who has been shaped and molded from a child. And this is where, if we have noticed that kids have emotional insecurities, and they are very appearing vulnerable and targeted by other children in schools, they have a higher risk of suicide, and they have a higher risk of being drawn into the wrong social groups, as a way of finding that acceptance. So again,
I've noticed that.
you can have kids, let's say you've got kids that have got into the wrong crowds because of their own insecurities and feeling abandoned, feeling having low self-worth, and they are coerced into engaging in criminal activity, and they do it because they're like, well, if I don't do it, well, I'm going to be rejected by these as well. I'm going to have nobody. So they can be coerced into engaging in criminal activity through as a result of their people pleasing risk, fixer mentality, parts that they have developed as coping mechanisms throughout their life. So it's just, yeah, there's loads of very, this is why all roots back to mental health, the emotional well-being of a child, and understanding exactly what childhood trauma is, because a lot of people don't understand childhood trauma. They think it is just growing up in a war zone, and it's absolutely not. It could be, because it's remember, it's how that child perceives something. So as an adult, we can look back on our childhood and say, oh, well, of course, mum and dad were just doing their best. Mum and dad were just keep doing, working all the time to give us a good life and keep food on the table and keep a roof over our head. Mum would, as an adult, we can rationalize that. So when I say to people, what was your childhood like? They say, oh, I had a great childhood. Yeah, as an adult, you can rationalize that. But as a child, how did you feel as a child? How did you feel as a child? That's different. So did you translate that as, mum and dad really don't, I'm not important to them. They do not care about me. I'm invisible. They don't want to do anything with me. They don't love me. I'm worthless. And I have to get really good grades to be feel worthy of their love. I have to become successful to be worthy of their love. This is where all this is shaped. I mean, it's very common for, I don't know, let's say if you feel pressured to, let's say, oh, I don't know, everybody's been lawyers in the family or doctors in the family. There may be a pressure and an expectation to gain really high grades to be able to go through med school. And maybe that's not their passion, but they're like, well, I have to play along, because if I don't play along, well, I'm going to be rejected. And they're not going to be, I'm going to be seen as a black sheep of the family and a reject. And oh, now, well, now I'm not getting my grades. Oh, sugar. Oh. It's all of this. So this is where, when we talk about childhood trauma, this is what we're referring to. It comes in so much, in all shapes and sizes, childhood trauma. So when we're looking at a child's behavior, we have to understand, what are they feeling? What emotions are behind the behaviors? And where are these emotions coming from? What's happening in their environment that's causing them to feel like they do? And why are these coping mechanisms developing? But the key is not to say, oh, well, there's a reason, so that means we need to feel sorry for them. No, we need to teach them that actually that behavior is not acceptable. That's not the way we go about our life. That's not, we don't treat people like that. So we have to teach them very early on that boundaries are in place for a reason. Boundaries are in place to keep them safe and other people safe.
Yep.
And we if they don't respect those boundaries, then we put in place age-appropriate consequences. We don't make excuses for, oh, well, it's not their fault because they've got ADHD or they're autistic or they're this or they're that. Because regardless of what label they have been assigned by a psychologist, the brain is still responding to the environment that is threatening.
Yes. Yeah.
Regardless of what label. So it's, why is that landscape? Why is their environment a threat to them? What's going on in their environment that they are perceiving as inescapable, emotionally dangerous?
Yes.
Which is resulting in these undesirable coping mechanisms coming to the surface to protect them from feeling something. They're protector parts. That's it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Making excuses isn't going to help the situation. It's just not. So it's just such a complex topic.
Isn't it? It is. Absolutely.
Yeah. So we're just going to break for another interval and we shall see you after the break.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Optimizing your health and well-being is on your to-do list? Then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one super supplement brand, help you achieve that in the most convenient and comprehensive way possible. Clean, premium ingredients scientifically formulated to work in synergy to support immunity, energy, joints, heart health, sleep, emotional balance, and more. Benefit from the power, purity and positivity of our award-winning powder sachets or our therapeutic capsule range. Use code RADIO15 at reviveactive.com and save 15% off today. Super supplements for a super you.
Cappuccino, latte, Americano, flat white, macchiato.
Just imagine, for less than the price of a single cup of coffee out on the high street, you could enjoy an award-winning online magazine every month with up-to-the-minute information on health and healthy lifestyle. Sounds like a good trade-off? Check out Health Triangle magazine on the UKHealthRadio.com website. Just sacrifice a single cup of coffee every month.
Let's all put health first.
The station that makes you feel good.
So welcome back. So before we wrap up, what would you say to other men, Alistair, in regards to the ones that are behaving in unacceptable ways towards women in particular? And those who've got younger, you know, teenage children in particular, because obviously they are learning from them. What would you say?
I do, yes. Okay. Well, for one thing, probably the first thing is I wouldn't say to the men, not in the sense of giving a pep talk or trying to convince them that what they have done is toxic and unacceptable. The approach I would take is to be curious about their behaviors and explore what they were actually feeling when it happened. And when they thought that they needed to behave in that particular way. And I would also dare, and I'm saying this also, given that the assessment process prior to joining the group covers this sort of ground anyway, and I found it useful. I'd also try to get them to, I'd encourage them to consider how the victim might have felt when they became recipients of this toxic behaviour.
I mean, that certainly would, certainly is very beneficial for younger people before the entitlement becomes too heavily embedded, is using that reverse psychology. Well, if you were treated that way, how would you feel? If somebody did that to you, how would that make you feel? Yeah.
Yes. And then, look, I wish I could sit here and say to you, oh, that's a brilliant tactic. It works every time. It doesn't.
It doesn't.
It doesn't. I mean, a handful of the men get it. I would say probably the majority wouldn't get that sort of a question. How did you feel? How do you think your wife felt when you slapped her? Oh, I don't know. Angry, maybe? Yeah, I mean, they're guessing. They don't know. Okay, take them at their word. How would you feel if you were slapped? Now, that may get a bit more traction because, you know, a lot of the time, okay, they could resonate with that. And of course, that also may be something from their own background. They've experienced violence and brutality growing up. And if they have, then okay, they can explain, they can understand that.
What would you say to professionals then? What would you say to professionals still working in this space? What would your advice be to them now in terms of getting a grip of this growing problem?
Now I've become a global expert. I think, you know, my approach, and it would still be, my tendency is to, how can I put it, be interested in the other person.
Yeah.
Find out who they are, where they've come from, what they've experienced.
Find out
what their story is.
Get curious.
Yeah, be curious. In a nutshell, be curious.
It's never black and white. Yeah.
No, it's never black and white, and, you know, curious rather than judgmental. And I think the first time the men enter that room that we were in, that's what they were expecting. Because our justice system is very adversarial, isn't it?
It is,
in the UK. And that's what they're used to as well. But we actually, I think the people running the groups actually did a reasonable job of not being judgmental and dealing with people as they found them. But I still don't think there was enough finding the story, being curious.
Yeah. And it's not about being judgmental, it's about risk management, is what it is. Are those behaviours a risk to other people? And it's, you know, irregardless of what they are, their background is. And this is where it is, we are, it's important to identify the motive and what's behind it, because it's helping professionals to understand and identify risk. So if
That's
we don't
very,
nip
very
in the bud early, then the more that behavior is reinforced, the more it's just going to intensify. And
good. Indeed.
it's better not only for the victims, obviously, but it's better for the perpetrator if you nip it in the bud early and you give them consequences early, as opposed to like that example I gave you of, where, the 18-year-old was blackmailed every day, clear, very clearly blackmailed by that 15-year-old. He felt entrapped. He felt like he had no way out. He was fearful, full of judgment, humiliation, and that's what it resorted to. So, rather than it escalating to the point where behaviors are reinforced over a long period of time and it results in a fatality, it's much better than getting a softer punishment earlier on, nipping the behavior in the bud and saying, we ain't going to tolerate this behavior, than making excuses, brushing it under the carpet, and then, oh, now somebody's lost their life. Oh, well, now they're going to prison for 30 odd years, however long they are sentenced for. They're also doing an injustice to the perpetrator, the perpetrating party, by not holding them accountable. So this is what people lose sight of. Yes, they think that they are helping by making excuses for the behaviours. However, they're doing them injustice because by reinforcing the behaviour, the behaviours will escalate. And then ultimately, when it gets to the point where they do take somebody's life, then you have no choice but to enforce severe consequences. And actually, that could have been avoided. Not only could we have avoided a fatality, but we could have avoided somebody going to prison for the rest of their life. So they're doing an injustice, not just to the victim, but they're doing an injustice to the perpetrator as well, who, as they keep pointing out, but they've got mental health problems. It's not their fault. Well, maybe their background is not their fault. However, the undesirable coping mechanisms that they have now are now taking advantage of and using to their advantage are is their fault. But unfortunately, the system is all equally to blame because they've allowed those behaviours to be reinforced and enabled. So by reinforcing them, enabling them, they're not doing them any favours. They're actually doing them an injustice.
A huge one, and making a worse situation for themselves, and
100%, 100%.
it's all lose, lose, lose.
Yeah, it is. It is. Yeah.
And of course, the 18-year-old's family is not without complicity.
No, because why did he feel that like that in the first place? Why did he feel that he couldn't come to his go to his family? And open up about his sexuality, and
Well,
that's a failure within the family unit.
in a previous universe, I have been an Anglican priest, and I'm very well aware of how judgmental and unswerving some religious organizations can be about gay children. And it's horrendous. And the children are cut off from their family, these people that they've grown up with. And imagine the trauma that they feel. And so, I mean, just having that threat is enough. It's bad enough.
It doesn't mean to say that he's not a risk. Of course, he's a risk. But equally, you know, we have to look at what resulted in that bit that coming about in the first place. And there was failures on the family side, and there was obviously direct targeting from the victim as well. Yeah, and then we've got to look at, well, you know, why was the victim the way he was? Why was he engaged in coercive, controlling, and blackmailing behaviour? Well, he's learned that from somewhere also.
Where did that come from?
Exactly. You know, so these are all the things that we need to consider, because it shouldn't need to get to the point where somebody resorts to murder. It shouldn't, but it shouldn't ever get to that stage. And actually, the system has the power within its hands to micromanage it from a very early age. They do. If they have the skills and the understanding, they have the power to micromanage that moving forward. Is it an easy process? No, it's not.
No.
But neither, you know, at the end of the day, it costs £2 million in the UK anyway to investigate a murder.
Well,
and that's not including all the manpower and the time and the devastation it causes to all the family members and the loved ones. And, you know, the fallout is huge, You know, and, you know, and like I said in this case, there was fault on both sides. But as a result of that, both families have now lost a child. Because although he was 18, he was only just an adult. Only just.
Do you have children?
I've got a very young daughter, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and
it doesn't matter how old they are, they're always your children.
Exactly.
Always.
But both families now have lost a child. One has lost a child, you know, to obviously the child's life's been lost, and the other one is gonna spend his life in prison, a lot of his life in prison. So you know, there's a loss on both sides. You know, there's a fallout with both the victims and the perpetrator's family. And I know Brianna and Gray, you know, Brianna's mum speaks to the perpetrator's mother frequently, and apparently she's devastated. She's devastated. So there is fallout on both sides, out of the family. It just is better to address it in its infancy stages and not make excuses for bad behaviour. No label excuses that behaviour. None. It just doesn't.
No, it doesn't.
Nothing a victim says or does to you justifies taking somebody's life. We all have a choice. All of us have a choice. Mm.
Yeah.
I mean, I've actually interviewed, I talk to her regularly. She's one of the survivors of the Bradford grooming gangs. And she ended up after getting out of the grooming gang, she ended up in a domestic abuse relationship. Well, she ended up going to prison for stabbing her perpetrator because she said it was either me or him. You know, I knew what he was tending on doing, and it was either me or him, and I grabbed it before he stabbed me. And but she says, did I have a choice in that moment? Of course I did. I could have to do something different. And even though that was to protect her life, she could have chosen something different, but she chose to do that. And she said, I scared myself as to what I was capable of doing.
Good.
So
yes, we do.
So again, you know, it's just when I say obviously that 15-year-old was not faultless, he wasn't faultless. You know, for anybody to sit there and say that he's an innocent in all this and he's poor, that poor boy didn't understand. No, he understood. And unfortunately, those actions resulted in what it did. Nothing justifies it, but either way, if he hadn't have done that, he would still be alive today. If he had just let things go and not blackmailed this boy, he would still be alive today.
Yeah.
And this is where, you know, there are cases where the victim is not completely innocent in the what transpired. And that's where we need to look at what was driving that perpetrator, the killer in this case, is motive. What was driving the behaviour? What was going on in his mind? And it can happen with any victim. Any victim can respond and react, react as obviously Gemma Smith did. You know, she reacted and responded in to survival. What she did was wrong, but ultimately, we've got to understand why she did it. We have to understand that. If we don't understand it, we can't understand motive.
Well, no, we can't. And but yet, you know, I don't want it to be perceived as heartless by my saying good that she felt bad about what she did. I mean, to me, that actually shows that she lived beyond that moment. And the thing that parallels me is that part of Lawrence of Arabia where Lawrence starts killing people and he later admits he enjoyed it. Now that is toxic, that is pathological. I mean, if you can kill somebody and say, I'm horrified at what I did, then okay, there's hope. But if you enjoy doing that, there's a problem.
Yeah, 100%. 100%.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Alistair. It's been great having you on.
Thank you, Kate. I've enjoyed being here.
And we shall see you on the next episode.
Thank you for tuning in and being part of this vital conversation. If you feel inspired to take action and support women, girls and children affected by abuse, please visit the show notes in Kate's bio on UK Health Radio. There you can register your interest in becoming a certified trauma-informed expert, specialising in topics that address this ever-growing crisis. Together, we can shape a safer future for those who need it most. Until next time, stay strong, stay informed, and remember, you are never alone.